Barry Sonnenfeld's dark humor just might have something to do with his mother.
While Jimi Hendrix was warming up at 2:20 in the morning over the Madison Square Garden PA system, came the following announcement, which was, of course, the title of my book, Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother.
We talk with the filmmaker about his memoir, Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother. Then Katie Simpson Smith tells us about her new novel of historical fiction, The Everlasting. It's a quadruple love story spanning 2,000 years. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. Filmmaker Barry Sonnenfeld's philosophy is, regret the past, fear the present, dread the future. It's a pessimistic creed he developed early as the son of two truly mishugana parents. Constantly threatened with suicide by his overprotective mother, disillusioned by the father he worshipped, and abused by a demonic relative, Sonnenfeld somehow went on to become one of Hollywood's most successful producers and directors. His memoir, Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother, is a hilarious recounting with tragic elements about coming of age and going to Hollywood. Along the way, Sonnenfeld also got to fire Donald Trump. We should all be so lucky. Barry Sonnenfeld worked as a cinematographer for the Coen brothers before directing such films as The Addams Family and its sequel Addams Family Values, as well as the Men in Black trilogy, Big and Get Shorty. He also produced TV series such as A Series of Unfortunate Events, The Tick, and Fantasy Island. Barry Sonnenfeld, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be talking with you.
So, I would say this is kind of a tragic comic book with more on the comedy, but the comedy informed by the tragedy. The title of this book is Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother. Tell us about that title. Where did you get it from?
Sure. Well, first of all, I think just like a hero is only as good as their villain, I think tragedy plays an important role in comedy. I think the tragedies in my book help you enjoy the comedy that much more. And an example is how the book got its title. I was 17 years old and I was a senior at high school at Music and Art. And I was with my girlfriend at the first peace concert against the Vietnam War. It was at Madison Square Garden. There were about 20,000 people and various artists sang Peter, Paul and Mary, the cast from Hair, Chad Mitchell Trio. And at 2:20 in the morning, while Jimi Hendrix was warming up for the second time, because he had stormed out earlier in the night because he wasn't feeling the vibe. Anyway, while Jimi Hendrix was warming up at 2:20 in the morning over the Madison Square Garden PA system, came the following announcement, which was, of course, the title of my book, Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother. Now, this says so much about my mother. I always said that she had strength through weakness. The fact that she was able to get anyone to pick up the phone at Madison Square Garden at 2 in the morning and then get transferred through, I'm sure, a myriad of protectors to finally get to speak to the PA announcer at Madison Square Garden to convince them that something had happened so dire that I had to be paged while Jimi Hendrix was warming up. So in my mind, that could be only one thing, which is that my father had died. So now I'm both weeping uncontrollably. I stand up, which means I've announced to everyone in my area that I am indeed Barry Sonnenfeld. Of course, since we're at the garden, the chant of Barry, Barry start to expand from the cheap blue seats where I am down to the orange and red seats, heading towards Jimmy. I get to a payphone, because this is way before cell phones or anything, or pagers even. I'm now weeping uncontrollably. I call my mother. I said, "Who died?" And she said, "Well, I thought you did." And I said, "Didn't they tell you the concert was still going on?" And she said, "Yes, but you were supposed to be home at 2. It was 2:20, and they couldn't tell me that you were there, so I assumed you were dead." That's Mom.
Now, that's pretty funny, but what's really behind it is really not all that funny. Both your parents, you know, were, I would say, the word that comes to mind has to be horrific in some ways.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. So talk a little bit about that, and also kind of the role that you played in their marriage, which was an extremely difficult one.
Well, it was a loveless marriage as far as my father was concerned. I once asked my father, "What did you see in Mom that made you decide to marry her?" And he said, "You know, I don't know." So they were both different versions of narcissists. My mother's narcissism, they were both equally about themselves, but Mom was always physically ailing. She had hypochondriacal diseases, you know, angina, migraines, backaches, phlebitis. I never knew if any of these were really true or not. And basically lived on her bed with a wet towel over her face. My father, on the other hand, was the most optimistic guy in the world, which made no sense since we rarely had electricity or could pay the rent or pay Lou the butcher for our briskets, but was always optimistic, always thought things were going to work out. In fact, he did give me great advice when I was growing up, because neither one of them wanted me to be a traditional Jewish job person like a lawyer or a doctor or an accountant. My mother wanted me to be an artist of some kind. And Dad said, "Just figure out what would bring you joy in life, and you'll figure out a way to make a living doing it," which is really good advice coming from someone who was always filing for Chapter 11, but he did enjoy his life. They were both narcissists, and they both brought me into this weird marriage triangle. When I was 5, my mother did her first, at least to my knowledge, attempt at suicide. My father woke me up from my bed and told me, "Your mother wants to kill herself. Go in and convince her not to." So all my life, I've been sort of sucked into this sort of unfortunate marriage. They were married over 50 years. And when my mother died, my father, my mother was still married to each other. It was a loveless marriage that had dozens of affairs, but they never divorced.
Now, I can't go on without referencing, I think, the most horrific part of this relationship, not of the relationship between your parents, but of their relationship to you, which is their utter failure to protect you from CM the CM. Tell us what
that's
that
right. CM the CM stands for Cousin Mike the Child Molester. Mike was my mother's first cousin. He had a terrible temper, and he had gotten fired from WMCA, where he claimed he created the phrase "the good guys." But Mike, not unlike my mother, was also a pathological liar. For several years, Mike lived on our living room's couch. He slept there for several years. And throughout my life, even when he wasn't staying with us, would be at our house once every 2 weeks. We would go to Jones Beach. We would do various things with him. He worked by this point at NBC. And they kind of knew, I never knew how much till near the end of my father's life, but they allowed Mike to molest the kids in my apartment building, various nieces and nephews, and me. We were all molested by Mike. And 50 years later, a few years ago, while my dad was still alive, I read an article by a neighbor of mine in my apartment building who talked about being molested by someone and how it totally had screwed up his life. And from what I read, I realized that this writer lived in my apartment building. I tracked him down. I asked if we could have breakfast together. We did. And he told me that Mike molested him for several years. In fact, he burnt down his apartment in our apartment building, which forced his parents to move so he could get further away from CM to CM. So I went to my dad, who was, I don't know, 94 at the time. And you never know what they did or didn't know. But I said to Dad, did you hate Mom so much that you let Mike live with us, molesting me and all of your nieces and nephews and our neighbors, just because Mom had someone to hang out with because you didn't want to hang out with her? Dad said, look, Barry, there are three reasons. It's like he knew I was going to ask. He had the three reasons ready for me. One, don't forget, child molestation didn't have the same stigma then that it has now. Not a good answer. Two, don't forget that your mom was so depressed and unhappy because of all the affairs I was having. I thought having Mike around would give her pleasure. And three, I never thought Mike molested you. I only thought he was playing with your penis. So at that point, your brain goes tilt. The game is over. The lights come on. The electricity goes off. And you say to your dad, I said to my dad, all right, well, thanks a lot. I'm out of here. Because somehow you hope that maybe they didn't know to what extent. But there's my father readily admitting that my parents knew what was going on. And I was devastated. I suffer from sciatica in the best of times, one of the many things I've inherited from my mother's psychological profile. And I went home and I wept for hours. And that was pretty much it between me and my father.
You know, given this background, and you do say in this book, Barry Sonnenfeld, you say that you... or that people say that you are, by all accounts, one of the most neurotic people on the planet. And yet you're hugely successful. You have had a long and happy marriage. At least that's what you report in this wonderful book. And by the way, very funny book. So what do you feel that it took for you to have this kind of joy and success in your life in spite of, you know, in fact, you weren't really destroyed by the CM, the CM.
Right. I wish I could tell you. I will tell you that if you look at what I'm drawn to, whether as a cinematographer or as a director or a producer, they tend to be quirky comedies with a surreal or dark side. In television, Pushing Daisies, which I won an Emmy for, and the Directors Guild of America Best Directing of a TV Show for, or the three seasons I was the executive producer and directed a lot of episodes of A Series of Unfortunate Events. They're sort of dark and quirky, and in the case of A Series of Unfortunate Events, it's very autobiographical because the books and our TV show pretty much posit that children are capable and wonderful, and all adults, whether they mean well or are villains, are equally ineffectual. And for me, that's totally autobiographical. In fact, I begged my parents all my life to tell me I was adopted just so I could feel better about myself. In the world of movies, whether it's Adam's Family, Men in Black, when I was a director, or some of the movies I did with the Coen brothers as a cinematographer, Blood Simple, Raising Arizona, Miller's Crossing, they all are kind of, oh, Throw Mama from the Train and Big. They're all both comedies with a little bit of darkness to them. And I guess somehow, you know, there are some comedians that live pretty much normal, healthy lives. Jerry Seinfeld, Robin Williams. They didn't come from strife or screwed up childhood. And other children, I think, sort of feed on the surreal, dark world that they grow up in. And I think I'm obviously more the second than the first.
You also grew up in a very, let's say, a richly Jewish, culturally Jewish environment. And your philosophy, you say in this book, Barry Sonnenfeld, in Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother, is regret the past, fear the present, dread the future. And that is really within, that's also a very Jewish kind of context. It actually kind of reminded me of the song. Do you know that song in that wonderful comedy, 12 Chairs? Hope for the best, expect the worst.
Oh, you know what? I remember 12 Chairs from years ago. I think that's way too optimistic. Hope for the best, prepare for the worst. I think I would be prepare for the worst, hope it's not as bad as it possibly could get. You know, my philosophy as expressed in that forward, regret the past, fear the present, dread the future, is there's no upside to optimism. If you're a pessimist and things go badly, you're not disappointed. You were expecting the worst. If you're a pessimist and things go better than terribly, hey, you won.
I think there is something peculiarly Jewish about this, I guess, the sense of pessimism that you're talking about, but humor. You know, some of the best comedians that we have in our culture have been Jewish. You just spoke about your darkly comic masterpieces, really. And it seems to me more and more that this is the philosophy that is for our time. I mean, look at where we are.
No, where we are is not, it's really hard to find comedy where we are now. And and truthfully, it's what's very disconcerting is it's really hard to watch comedies or anything. You know, we watch a lot of streaming television, not through the filter of where we are today, this very day. So you watch a scene and two people get together and hug, and you feel different about that hug. It's the weirdest thing. And it's not their fault. You're watching a movie that was done 40 years ago. There was no COVID-19. But you can't help bring today's mores and today's gestalt to watching these old movies. And it's the weirdest, creepiest thing. And it's almost like, I remember when I was shooting Men in Black 2, the whole ending of Men in Black 2 took place on the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center. We had permission. So throughout the shooting of that movie, we found locations where you could see the Twin Towers in the distance so that we were sort of presaging, pay attention, those towers are going to be important. We got done shooting all of our New York stuff. We went to LA to shoot all of our stage stuff. We were about to shoot the roof of the World Trade Center, which we built on the stage, when the Twin Towers were destroyed. Not only did we have to come up with a new ending, but we had to re-edit our film and, using visual effects, erase the Twin Towers from all these other shots because it was too creepy and sad to have those towers in the background, and it would inform people's feelings about that scene. And in the same way, it's hard to watch anything in May of 2020 without wearing the glasses of COVID-19. It's a very surreal experience.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with film director, producer, and cinematographer Barry Sonnenfeld about his memoir, Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother. So let's get back to this wonderful memoir. I mean, we've been talking about pretty serious and distressing things, and yet I have to say I have not laughed as much since I can remember as I did, well, throughout the book, but especially your first paying job out of film school, which was working for a porn film producer named Dick.
Yep. At graduate film school, I discovered that I had an ability to be a cameraman. I was good at lighting. I was very good technically. I loved still photography, so I knew my way around lenses and framing and designing shots. And I decided when I got out of film school, if I bought a used 16 millimeter camera, and you have to remember this is before the age of digital photography. So right now you would just be filming everything on video. But back then, there was only film. So I thought that when I got out of film school, if I owned a camera, I could legitimately call myself a cameraman without feeling like a dilettante. Because there I was, I owned a camera. So I bought a $5,000 used CP16 reflex with a buddy of mine named Bob. And I don't know if I call him Bob in the book, but he had a friend who was a porn producer who was about to shoot 9 feature-length porns. And by us working on these porns and renting the camera back to him, we would basically pay off 2/3 of the entire cost of the camera in just these 9 days. So for 9 days, I shot 9 feature-length pornos. It's the only pornos I ever did. And I learned a lot about how truly disgusting pornos are. I won't go into any details, but they're totally unerotic. Dick never managed to find an erotic way to shoot any scene. But the other thing that was really interesting to me is how much power the women, the actresses, had in the porn business, because the actresses can fake an orgasm. They can fake being happy. Men can't. Men, you've got to see semen coming out of a penis or you don't have an orgasm. So the actresses can either help or hurt those men to achieve their orgasm. And the actresses knew this and had all the power. It was truly 9 days of hell. And it ended after a horrible experience involving fecal matter. It ended with me then leaving after 9 days of filming on this loft at 17th Street and 5th Avenue, waiting at 14th and 5th for the crosstown bus to take me back home to 7th Street between the A and B where I lived, and getting mugged. So I call the chapter Insult to Injury. So after everything that went wrong personally on this porno, and you have to read the book to hear more, I then get mugged while smelling terribly, let's just say.
On your birthday?
On my birthday. It was April 1st. I was 26 years old. But I'm glad you talked about the comedy, because I think the book is very funny. My people who have read it have told me that they've laughed out loud while reading it. And sort of the first half is the surrealness of growing up with these two narcissists, mom and dad. And the second half is how I ended up accidentally getting into the film business and going from being a cinematographer to being a director. And my book was twice as long. I literally cut out 80% of what I had written because I didn't want the book to be 600 pages. But I loved writing it, and I loved retelling these stories. And I named names, which a lot of people don't do.
And speaking about naming names, you say in this book that during the making of a star-studded Macy's commercial in which I had to fire Trump for bad behavior, and I kind of got stuck on that. I don't remember the rest of that sentence. You fired Donald Trump for bad behavior?
Yeah. Remember there used to be those Macy's commercials that would show, all the famous people that had branding that were selling through Macy's. So Martha Stewart, Emerald, Usher, Jessica Simpson, Donald Trump was selling his Trump vodka, I think. So there would be these Macy's commercials where they got all of their big stars together, and we was filming one that was supposed to be a Thanksgiving dinner in the lobby of Macy's, where we had all these actors. So the setup, we built a fake version of the lobby at Steiner Studios in Brooklyn. The setup is we track down this long table using this thing called the techno crane, which is very large and has an arm that sticks out and is motorized. It's very complicated. And you go down the table and you pass Emerald and Martha and Queen Latifah and Usher, and you keep pulling back, and everyone's having this wonderful Thanksgiving dinner, and we keep pulling back, and it ends with Donald Trump sitting with three little kids who were like 5 or 6 years old, and Trump turns to the camera in this wide shot and says, "How did I get stuck here?" or something like that. "How did I get put at this table?" So I said, "Cut." And then I said to Donald, "Okay, great. We just got to get a close up of you, and then you can leave, Donald." And Donald said, "Not from that side." He said, "That's not my good side. You have to film me from my other side." And I said, "Well, I can't, because you're looking the camera, you know, there's something called screen direction, and you're looking from left to right. If I put the camera on the other side, that you'll be looking from right to left, and it won't look like you're at the same table." And he said, "Well, that's not my good side. Figure out how to put the camera to photograph me on my good side, or I'm leaving." And I said, "Okay, well, you can go." And he said, "Without my close-up?" I said, "Well, yeah, it's okay. It works in a wide shot." He goes, "You need a close-up of Donald Trump." And I go, "Well, not really. And truthfully, you don't want me to shoot you from your bad side, and I can't shoot you from your good side. So go, it will be fine. Just go, leave." And he said, "I'm going to leave." And, you know, he turned to the clients and the ad agency and the Macy's people. He said, "I'm leaving." And they looked at me, and I said, "Yeah, no, it's okay. We got it." So Trump storms off. I go to set up the next shot, which is a single of Martha Stewart. And I'm setting up for that shot. And there's a tap on my shoulder, and Trump is there. And he says, "All right, you can shoot me from my bad side." And I said, "Oh, no, we've moved on. You're out of here. Go. Goodbye. We don't need you." He said, "I'm going to leave." I said, "I thought you left 20 minutes ago." So that's one of my three Donald Trump stories, but the only one that's in the book.
Well, actually, it isn't in the book to that extent, and it's such a telling story. You know, just talk about narcissism. I'm sure Trump has got even your parents beat on that one.
Yeah, you know, he's truly the most neediest, insecure person I've ever met. And all you want is to be surrounded by secure, smart people, whether they're your children or your friends. And all you want for your children is to feel secure and self-confident. And we have, unfortunately, a president who is the singular most insecure, narcissistic. Well, he's a sociopath, but it's a problem. Let's just say that. Mm.
So final question. If Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother, gets optioned, who do you want playing you?
I already know that answer. And Warner Brothers Television and Rob Reiner and Alan Zweibel are in negotiations to option the rights. And I want multiple people to play Barry, because I think the joy of the show, and I'd love to have it on a streaming service, is that you want young Barry to inform old Barry. So within any episode, you want a 10-year-old Barry, a 25-year-old Barry, a 35-year-old Barry, and a 60-year-old Barry. But I want Max Greenfield. He's too good-looking to play me, but I still think he has such a great comic timing. He's a good-looking Jewish boy, and he's around, how old, Chloe? Around 40? He's around 40. He could play for Barry from almost 26 to 60. So I've already got it figured out. I'm hoping for it, and I want Max to be Barry. He's been studying me, and he's going to do a great job.
Oh, that's great. Well, we look forward to watching the film. There's so many wonderful stories in this book, Barry Sonnenfeld, If I Call Your Mother. We barely touch the surface, but it's been wonderful to talk with you.
Well, thanks so much.
Barry Sonnenfeld. Read a couple of excerpts from Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother, by going to writersvoice.net. And hey, do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our free podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. And like us on Facebook at Writer's Voice with Francesca Rhiannon, or find us on Twitter at Writer's Voice. And if you're listening to our podcast, give us some love on iTunes or whatever podcast app you use. It really helps others to find the show. Next up, Katie Simpson-Smith tells us about The Everlasting. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Katie Simpson-Smith used to be a historian. She wrote a book about motherhood in the American South in the early years of our nation's history. Her first two novels, The Story of Land and Sea and Free Men, both of which she's told us about on Writer's Voice, also took place in the American South. But for her latest novel, Katie Simpson-Smith turned to Rome. The Everlasting tells the story of four characters whose struggles resonate across the centuries: an early Christian child martyr, a medieval monk on crypt duty in the church, a Medici princess of Moorish descent, and a contemporary field biologist conducting an illicit affair. Each of the four grapple with common themes, such as the necessity for sacrifice and the power of love to sustain and challenge faith. And throughout, their struggles are witnessed and provoked by an omniscient, time-traveling Satan. Well, Katie Simpson-Smith, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
So I'm talking with you about your third work of historical fiction, The Everlasting. It's a fascinating construction of a book because you're spanning 2,000 years with four different stories, all in Rome, the city of Rome. First of all, just give us a brief introduction to each of these stories, just to orient us.
Sure. So moving sort of chronologically from the very earliest character, we have Prisca, who is a 12-year-old girl living in 2nd century Rome, who learns about Christianity from a passing traveler and becomes enraptured with this idea that the meek and the unlistened to of the earth might be able to inherit some power. So she becomes a convert and ends up making some very difficult decisions on behalf of this new religion that she believes in. And then in the 9th century, we have Felix, who is sort of banished from his home as a teenager when his family discovers that he is perhaps in love with another boy on the farm. And he ends up becoming a monk in Rome, where his duty is to watch the dead bodies of his fellow monks decompose in the monastery's crypt, which one would think would be a very squeamish kind of job. But he takes to it. He has a wonderful sense of humor and really embraces this different perspective on mortality. And then in the 16th century, we have Giulia de' Medici, who is based on a real Renaissance princess who has African ancestry and is trying to figure out how to assert her own strength and identity in a society that is not always willing to listen to women, and certainly not women of color. And finally, in the 21st century, we have Tom, who is a field biologist trying to figure out whether to have an affair with this magical and mysterious woman. And he is also studying these tiny crustaceans known as ostracods, which is, I think, his version of faith.
So faith is a constant in many ways in these stories. You know, all of these characters are so disparate. And as you say, Giuliana de' Medici is a historical character, but St. Prisca is also one as well.
Mm-hmm.
How did these figures come to you? I don't know if that's a fair question to ask, but is it something you can answer?
Yeah, it's hard to answer, although I think it's a perfectly fair question. I found myself gravitating towards certain eras, certain historical moments. I knew I wanted to write something about these sort of early days of Christianity and what that would look like on the ground. And as I started sort of homing in on certain years or decades within this broad sweep of Rome's history, the characters just kind of started popping up. So, you know, all I knew about the Middle Ages really was that, you know, the seat of learning was usually in churches and monasteries. And I thought, well, okay, those would be the most interesting people to write about. But what makes a particular monk interesting? And so that's when I thought of this character who's, you know, stuck in the crypt all day and trying to figure out how to have fun down there. So, yeah, it was a sort of a combination of finding moments that were really intriguing in terms of social and political change, and also the kind of humans who would be doing interesting things during those moments.
And you actually start with the 21st century. You know, Tom is interesting. I'd never heard of ostracods before, by the way. And he asks a really interesting question, which is, are they, you know, is nature like faith, a human construction? Talk about how you, you know, what is that question? Is nature like, I mean, I had to puzzle it over for a while.
Yeah. So he is working in this very large park on the outskirts of Rome. So it's still kind of an urban park, the Caffarella Valley. And what we take for wilderness there has actually been pieced together over the centuries by Romans who were trying to create a sense of wilderness as the city became more urban and built up. So he is trying to understand what the truly wild really looks like, because at least in the year 2015, when he is living, there are virtually no natural spaces that he's ever been in that have been untouched by humans. So he starts thinking about this different idea of, okay, if we know that we are constantly influencing nature, that maybe we should study, instead of studying animals or plants in their natural state, we should be studying how animals and plants have adapted to human presence. So he gets into this rhythm of looking at adaptation. And what's amazing about ostracods is that they survive through virtually any difficult kind of environment. So there were ostracods that were found in battlefields covered in oil and heavy metals, and they were still just sort of swimming through it all. They had figured out a way to exist within humans' wreck of the world. And I think Tom sees that as a kind of a way forward for his own vision of how to be in the world.
To adapt.
Yes, exactly.
Now, he confronts an ethical dilemma, which is an interesting one. First, he meets this mysterious young woman to whom he falls in love with her and is quite drawn to her. But he's on this research trip, which is supposed to be temporary. He's left his wife and his 9-year-old, I believe, daughter at home. It's not so difficult for him, it seems, to let go of his marriage, which has been fading for a long time. But to abandon his child is a real question. I wonder if you could talk about the dilemma that he faces.
Yeah, so I think it's one that a lot of parents face who are in difficult marriages, this sense of attachment and responsibility to the offspring of that marriage. You know, children who did nothing wrong, who are still deeply beloved. But where is the line between staying within the nuclear family unit to provide that kind of support system for a child and following one's own happiness and thereby leading by example, you know, showing your children that you can get out of situations that you're not happy in? So he's struggling with the sort of classic issues of divorce, but also being many thousands of miles away from his daughter, who's stuck in back home in California. And they, you know, Skype together and are doing all the sort of online kinds of interaction that we find ourselves now doing. I think that distance allows him a little bit too much leeway in terms of his own sort of emotional distancing. He thinks, I'm in Rome, I can do whatever I want. The city is magical. This woman appears who is fulfilling all my ideas about what passion looks like. And yet almost every night he's tethered via his webcam to this little girl who's asking all kinds of questions about where are you and what are you up to and when are you coming home? So he is, yeah, trying to figure out the balance between being a good father and following his own happiness.
And it's almost as if in real life he's living a fantasy, whereas his, you could argue, his real life is at home that he's living virtually.
Yeah. Yeah. And as an American tourist in Rome, there's this question of how much of Rome can be a reality for you, which I certainly experienced when I was traveling there. It's like, okay, this is this beautiful city, but it's never going to be my city fully. And so trying to figure out the balance between enjoying it, but also recognizing the kind of fantasy that you are creating of it.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with novelist Katie Simpson Smith about her newest novel, The Everlasting. So why Rome? What attracts you to Rome, and why did you decide to set this novel there?
So my first two books were set in the American South, which is where I was born and raised. And I didn't have a clear idea that I would ever leave the South in terms of subject matter. But back in 2015, I found myself with writer's block after the publication of my last novel and was trying to figure out ways that I could reset my brain and kind of erase the English language from it and find a sort of new well for inspiration. So I thought, okay, I'll go abroad. I'll go someplace where they don't speak English, where I am not particularly good at the language either. And it'll be kind of like a cleansing for my linguistic understanding of the world. So I went to Rome for a month. And, you know, the first week I was there, I just was walking around and taking everything in and, you know, staring open-mouthed at all the amazing art. And then by week two, I was carrying a little notebook with me and, like, writing down little, like, snippets of things that I was seeing. And then by week three, I had, you know, a Word document open on my computer, and I was writing things out and outlining things, and I thought, oh boy, I'm going to write a novel about this place, which was intimidating because I have a background as a historian, but I know nothing about Roman history. That is certainly not my specialty. So I really had to start from the ground up in terms of figuring out, you know, 2,000 years of what this city looked like.
So go for a journey and deal. That's a great way to deal with writer's block.
Yeah, I thought so.
That's wonderful. And actually, you know, when you do go on journeys, I know every time I go on a journey, I start a journal. So, So a journal is a wonderful way to also overcome writer's block.
Exactly. Yeah.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with novelist Katie Simpson Smith about her new book, The Everlasting. Then we go to 1559, Giulia de' Medici. She's actually my favorite character in this book, I have to say. She has such amazing brilliance and spirit at a time when, you know, as you say, women, much less a woman of color, you know, are treated as unimportant and inferior. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit more about her dilemma that she faces.
Yes. So she's a woman who comes from wealth and power, despite being sort of personally shut out of a lot of those conversations. And she is married off to a man who she is not in love with, but that is, you know, par for the course in 1559. But in sort of her preparations for the wedding, she is painted by a man who is hired by her sort of stepmother slash guardian to do an official portrait of her. And he comes several times a week to their house in Florence to paint her, which is a very intimate kind of exchange to stand in front of someone and have them watch you so closely for hours. So naturally, she finds herself falling in love with him and ends up becoming pregnant just as she is marrying this other man. And so her sort of chief dilemma is how to deal with this pregnancy in a way that both respects the child within her, but also takes into account the father that would be raising her, which is not a man that she is in love with at all. And of course, you know, ideas about children and especially about unborn children and fetuses were very different back then. And so she is kind of taking into account religious information and medical information, but also her own sense of authority over her own body.
And in many ways, she's a modern woman.
Yes.
Was that difficult? I mean, she's a historical character. There are actually portraits of her. I don't know if that was what you were basing the imagined portrait in this book. But to imagine yourself into the mind of a historical character who lived hundreds of years ago, I've always been curious about how do you do that?
Yeah, it's harder for characters who are based on real people because you have a sense of you don't have as much license to kind of go wild with how you imagine them. But what I love about certain kinds of historical figures is when they don't leave a lot of historical records behind, but clearly have a lot that was left unsaid. And Giulia de' Medici is one of those characters for me. We have some notes around her life based on other people who lived with her or knew her, but she didn't leave much behind. And so we have these tantalizing biographical details. You know, she had darker skin than the other young girls that she was raised with in this kind of blended family. But there's a detail where the woman who raised her takes a note of a series of cloaks that she fancied, dress cloaks that she's ordering for her wards. And most of the children are her biological children, and there's a couple of adopted children. But she records that Giulia insisted on having the exact same level of fanciness in her cloak as the natural-born children. And so I thought, okay, like, here's a girl who is very aware of a disparity in status and who takes pains to erase that disparity by standing up for herself. And so little glimpses into a character like that allow me to kind of just take her and spin out all kinds of scenarios in which I think she would be able to have that same kind of spunk. So yeah, writing people that we have glimpses of and not full portraits of, I think those are my favorite.
Yeah, and you know, her husband basically assaults her sexually, and yes, she gives him what for?
Yes.
Then we go further back, as you say, to the monk Felix. I had never heard of a putridarium. What is the process of watching his fellow monks, you know, decompose? What's that about?
Yes. So putridariums were not super common, but there were several monasteries in Rome and Naples and especially Sicily that employed this particular kind of burial, or rather unburial style, where they would have a room in the crypt with benches on all four sides. And in the benches, there would be little holes that looked a little bit like a communal toilet, perhaps. And they would put the dead bodies of the brothers up on the toilets so that their bodily fluids would slowly over time leak out of them, and they would sort of dry up and become sort of brittle. And one monk, one living monk, would be sent down there to watch out for them, to be their guard. And the idea behind this was that he could witness the process of mortality, to see the soul literally fleeing the body over time, and then report back to the other monks about the wonders he had seen, about sort of God's mystery and God's miracles when it comes to the human body, which I find both very gross, but also very progressive. I think in contemporary society, we tend to hide our dead bodies. We don't talk about it. We immediately put them in the ground. It's not something that we want to contemplate. But I think what Felix shows us is that by engaging with them on a day-to-day level, he becomes so much more comfortable with his own body and with what happens to the body after death.
It's almost like the Tibetan Book of the Dead, you know, where you do a meditation. Maybe it's not the Tibetan Book of the Dead, but a Tibetan ritual where you imagine your own death as a way to live life more fully.
Yeah, to kind of normalize it, I think, is important.
And you made him gay, although I'm sure that word wasn't used back then.
Right.
I don't even think the word homosexual was used back then. So tell us a little bit about that. You know, he's really very much caught up with the relationship that he had with that young boy for which he was banished from his family.
Yes. So one interesting thing about this time period in the Middle Ages is that there were actually recorded quote-unquote marriages, not just between men and women, but between men. There are records of two men standing up together and some kind of priest figure performing a ceremony that marked their bond together. And there's a lot of debate among historians about whether these were actually sexual relationships or whether this was just a different kind of brotherhood that was being codified. But regardless, there are these things that Felix as a character can latch on to and think, okay, I might not be as abnormal as I think I am. But of course, within his family, who is a rural family, farming family, this behavior is shocking and outrageous, and he is forced to leave that life behind. But he finds this brotherhood in his church, which happens to be the Church of Santa Prisca, where he can perform love that is, as he thinks of it, holier and more pure, as a way to cleanse his own feelings of guilt about the love that he had.
Mm-hmm. Spiritual love.
Yeah, yeah.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with novelist Katie Simpson Smith about her new book, The Everlasting. So then there is Prisca, and I should say, I should introduce here the notion of the fish hook, because you actually have two elements that tie these stories together. One is a fish hook, which I'd like to ask you about now, and then I'll ask you about the figure of Satan, who makes an appearance throughout. So tell us about Prisca and then what is the significance? You have already told us about Prisca to a certain degree. So what I'd like to ask actually about Prisca is, you know, what is she really like? And she's really in a tradition, I think, of female Christian saints who are pubescent. You know, she's 12 years old. What do you make of this kind of tradition? And were you thinking of that when you created this character? Who is, of course, seen as a historical character?
Yes. So I, too, am fascinated by the ways in which women, and particularly young women, embrace Christianity in the early years. And I started writing Prisca's character trying to focus more on who she is as a girl and the realities of her life as a young girl before I started trying to fold in the Christian aspect to her story. And what I discovered as I was writing about her life on this sort of small farm outside of Rome is that, like any 12-year-old girl throughout history, I think, no one listens to her. She had an older brother who teased her mercilessly. Her dad is not really interested in the things she has to say. Her mom is just trying to train her to, you know, be a good cook and to learn how to clean and sew and things like that. But she has, you know, a wild imagination, and she wants to run in the fields and use her body physically. And she's a tomboy, but she is cut out of her society, and she is cut out even of her family. So she is feeling very isolated, and just that no one is paying attention. And I think those conditions, when you introduce a figure like Jesus, who says to his followers, you know, if you are meek and quiet and trampled on, then you are my, you know, true people. She's like, yes, finally, a religion that offers me power, that of course she's going to embrace that. And so watching her sort of transformation from this girl who's always underfoot, who no one really cares about, to someone who has a very loud voice and who ends up putting her life on the line for something that she's able to passionately believe in.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And so now the fish hook. What is this element? What role does it play?
Yes. So the fish hook we're introduced to, well, sort of chronologically introduced to, the book kind of moves around a lot, but it's something that she goes fishing with her father, and he gives her a hook to catch things while he's sort of sleeping on the bank of the river. And she ends up catching an eel with it. And it's the sort of first act of violence that she perpetrates to catch the eel, and then she has to kill the eel. And so the hook kind of becomes for her this symbol of the power of life and death. But it's also just a fishing hook, and she ends up losing it at some point. But the hook, like all good relics, reappears throughout the centuries, and is found by the monk Felix, and then later by Julia, and finally by Tom. And each of them imbue it with their own sense of what such a thing ought to mean. So in the case of Felix, who's living at this time when every scrap of a piece of fabric or a bone is immediately lifted up to be some holy relic of, you know, this must be Jesus's shroud, or this is, you know, St. Peter's knee bone, the hook becomes, you know, clearly related somehow to the apostles. And then that meaning changes when Julia finds it, and it changes again when it comes into the hands of Tom, who is basically an agnostic figure. So for me, it was really a way to see how ideas about faith and religion and meaning shift over the course of 2,000 years within a single place.
More of that kind of, is nature like faith a human construction?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
So this figure of Satan, you know, when I first encountered it, I was like, what's this? You know, he's talking about contemporary times and we're back in the 16th century. So why Satan?
Yeah, so when I first started writing some of these characters, whenever they asked a rhetorical question, this little voice appeared in my head that wanted to answer their rhetorical questions. And I tried to figure out who that voice was, whether it was just me as the narrator or whether it was someone a little bit more devious. And it turned out that the person I needed to write in that voice was Satan, partially because he is the only figure that can really span all the centuries easily. I wanted to have a kind of unifying link narratively between all of these stories. And so you have to sort of pick either God, who is all-seeing, or the devil. And God, for me, was too benevolent a figure. He would try to comfort these characters, tell them everything was going to be okay, convince them that, you know, love was the answer to everything, which just isn't very interesting in terms of character study. And the devil, meanwhile, has so many layers to him. He can play pranks on them, he can mislead them, but he can also sympathize with them in a way that God never could, because the devil has experienced the whole range of dark emotions that humans experience. You know, he too was basically broken up with by God and is heartbroken, cast out of this perfect world, just like humans in some ways are cast out. And so he is able to be a listening ear and also someone who kind of cheers them on as the book progresses with his own sense of how time and space will eventually sort of weave together.
Well, it is just, it's a wonderful journey through the ages, through these four characters, the everlasting. Katie Simpson Smith, I think you hit it out of the park once again. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Francesca.
Katie Simpson Smith. Go to writersvoice.net to hear our other interviews with the author about her novels, The Story of Land and Sea, and Free Men. Next week, join us as we talk with former Michigan gubernatorial candidate Dr. Abdul Al-Sayed about his book, Healing Politics. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.